This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. I'm your host, Mike Rappin, and with me this week are two amazing individuals, Kate Scotchless.
Hello.
And Nick White.
Hey.
I'm super excited that the both of you are here with me this week to talk about comic book adaptations of books. And I'm very happy that I said it correctly this time after the multiple recordings that we've done so far this week. But before we actually get started with the show and what we read and what we're excited for this upcoming week, I want to let everyone know that starting June 22nd going until July 13th, that's 4 weeks, we will be taking time off. Now, that doesn't mean that we aren't going to have a podcast for that week, but what it means is that we'll be releasing small mini-sodes that are going to be about 30 minutes long, featuring two of our regular guests talking about a single topic. No comic picks, no what we read, just the topics. So we'll be back to our regular show on July 20th, but we want to give everyone a heads up just so you know it's not going to be a regular I Read Comic Books episode. So that being said, let's actually dive into comic books, what we're excited about, you know, how we are as human beings in this great universe that is ever expanding, never collapsing in on us. Nick, how are you?
Pretty good. Wow. You know, how does one follow that up? Jeez, you know.
Dang. I'm setting the bar super high this
right.
week.
Right. I mean, I feel like this has got to get super philosophical real fast now. Things have been good. I had a good amount of time to get a decent amount of reading done. I read a Divinity 2. Finally got around to that so I could see what everybody was talking about. I have a lot of questions about it. Like, what exactly happened to Divinity? And why did we kill off Ninja L or Ninjal or whatever you want to call the agent who follows Ninjak? Why did we kill that person off so quickly? I also want to point out that I've now coined the term Valiant Wursk, which is the Russian version of the Valiant verse, which was seen in Divinity 2. That's trademarked. I'm sure Matt Kent is like, I actually came up with these ideas, so this claim is totally unfounded, but you know what?
We'll see you in court.
You know what? You're just jealous. I get it. That's fine. I read Darwin Cook's New Frontier number 3. Probably the best issue of the series so far. That's really saying something. It continues to get better and better. The use of the John Henry tall tale or mythology, the usage of that narrative to tell the story of John Henry Owens, otherwise known as Steel, was really powerful. I thought that was really great. The other crowning achievement of New Frontier and something Darwin Cook needs to go down in history for as one of his lesser known but very important accomplishments is the fact that he made Hal Jordan an actually sympathetic character. He's a Hal Jordan people feel bad for. He's actually a pacifist. He's definitely got some PTSD going on. I mean, it's one of the lesser, one of the understated points of New Frontier. So that's a big deal. Beyond that, I read 4001 AD number 2, which was still super, super action-y following number 1.
Oh, yeah.
I really kind of wonder if sort of the universe building and the heavy exposition and whatnot was really left for the one-shots and the Rye series, and like maybe this is supposed to be the big blockbuster stuff kind of isolated. It sort of left me, you know, wanting more, but on the other hand, it wasn't as visually confusing as 4080 number 1 was at points. Also read the EXO issue that accompanied it. Kind of, it's one of those issues where the simple chronology of how we know what goes down, you know, by 4001 sort of dictates what you already know is going to happen with the issue. Right. But that still didn't make it nonetheless kind of interesting. And it also included a really weird cameo of a character that goes all the way back to 2014's Armor Hunters event. And I'm really curious to see why they're suddenly roping in this character named Helix, who kills people by digitizing them into ones and zeros. So,
I mean, but that was the coolest part of that entire issue. I did read this as well, and I was like, this character feels like they were pulled out of an old 70s DC comic with the red and blue, like, goggles that he was wearing.
Yeah.
And then he turns people into, like, digital things. I didn't even know anything about this character, and I was like, this is a cool bad guy. I love it.
Yeah, Helix is one of the two armor hunters who actually survives at the end, and the other one gets put in jail, but Helix actually escapes, never to be seen until now. Other than that, I read Uncanny, the Andy Diggle, Aaron Campbell series for Dynamite. Really, really enjoyed that. I never got to finish it when I was trying to read it in print because I missed a couple issues, but I've thoroughly enjoyed this. It's really just a super taut plot. People have powers, but it doesn't get all mopey. Nobody gets super whiny or worries that the government is going to oppress them. It's not X-Men is what I'm saying. you know, there are just some people that have some weird abilities, and understandably, the, you know, sort of the, not really the government, but big corporations are trying to figure out how to weaponize these people.
Yeah.
So that's what I read. Really thoroughly enjoyed that series. Can't wait to read season two.
Cool. Yeah, I was just one small note about Uncanny. That series felt like what Heroes should have been to me.
Yeah.
And I really liked that part of it. Like, I really am happy that Andy Diggle was able to tell a story that was similar enough to something like Heroes, but unique enough that I wasn't worried that it was going to, you know, turn into, you know, Hiro Nakamura traveling through time trying to fix everything, and that there weren't going to be any, you know, stupid gimmicks. It's just a solid story about people with mysterious powers, and that's what I loved about Heroes and what I love about the X-Men in some ways. So this book is right up that alley of just really cool superpower story where everything is shrouded in mystery.
Yeah, and it's really grounded in real life, and I think that's what I really enjoy. It's not like to the nth degree where it's like, you know, Garth Ennis's the Boys, where it's like, oh man, life is so hardcore, and you know,
it's
so dark. But this is just feels very grounded. People have powers, but they don't feel the need to explain them in every panel, and it doesn't flesh itself out into this massive universe of like 17 different, you know, people with powers, and no one's getting killed off at a rate where, yeah, it doesn't have the problems that Heroes had. Absolutely.
Yeah. Cool. So Kate, what did you read this past week?
Well, I had a pretty busy week over here. I moved on Wednesday, so that was as exciting as moving always is. But it's a good thing. I'm excited about it. It's just packing up all your stuff and unpacking it is not an awesome time. But I actually read a few things in downtime. I did the DC Rebirth and Batman Rebirth issues, which I'm not going to expunge on because I completely agree with everything you and Nick and Paul talked about on the last episode. You hit the nail on the head, I think, with that stuff. I also read the Lucifer number one and Preacher number one. They were both free to promote the shows, respectively. Right. And I actually also watched the first, the pilot episode of Preacher. The comic is definitely better, in my humble opinion, but it is intensely Garth Ennis, at his most Garth Ennis-y, so reader beware, it is definitely not for children, and they toned it way down for the show, which is still pretty gory, but they changed the plot pretty substantially for the show, at least it seems like it, obviously I've read one issue and watched one episode, so, you know, grain of salt, but...
No, that's what I've heard from the people that have read, all of it. They say the show is already taking substantial deviations, but most people are actually okay with that.
Yeah, it seems like, but anyway, the big thing that I read that I really enjoyed was Civil War II, number one.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked it, although it was not quite what I expected. Now, in retrospect, looking back at all the promo art, I have no idea why I thought this, but I really thought it was She-Hulk versus Captain Marvel, but that becomes abundantly clear that that is not what's going down within the first issue, and no spoilers here, but She-Hulk's pretty out of commission.
Okay.
So, and that's part of what's making Tony Stark and Captain Marvel want to fight.
I'm so baffled. I've heard so many things about people saying... It made me really like Tony Stark for the first time. And I'm like, hold on. That means we've got a dramatic change in character to which I don't really know how I feel about that.
I completely agree. Some of the stuff he says, I'm like, wait, are you Tony Stark? Are we getting some alien counterfeit?
It's a Skrull.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a throwback all the way to Secret War, or whatever that was called.
Exactly. Jeez,
Secret Invasion.
The big thing that was amazing in it, though, was the art. The art is gorgeous. You could just look at this comic and be happy. The penciler is David Marquez, and the colorist is Justin Ponzer. And the two of them together are like a dream team. It's incredible. So, and they do big credit to David Marquez because he's drawing like dozens and dozens of Marvel heroes in this book. On like one panel, will have like 25 heroes.
Right,
and
it's an event.
He's combining all these different team books into one enormous, you know, thing. And so, and all of them are drawn completely differently, and uniquely, like none of them are standing the same, none of them are structured the same, you know what I mean? Like, it's just sometimes when you get these really big books, sometimes certain characters tend to start having, okay, there's the certain body type they use for these five, and then there's a certain, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we get that with a lot of character or, you know, artists like, what's his name, Humberto Ramos. You get that with Steve Niles, or not Steve Niles, Steve McNiven, Greg Land. They reuse a lot of the same body shapes and faces and stuff like that.
Yep,
it's just
exactly.
Unfortunate. But yeah, that's really good
and
to hear.
So this one doesn't have that, and it's beautiful.
Cool. I've been, everybody that I know has been telling me, like, Mike, are you reading this event? This is actually the event to read. And I'm like, God damn it, you guys. I just did Secret Wars last summer. You know, I did that.
It's all told $36. Like, if you only read the one, like, the title line of Civil War II, it is $6 a pop, but it's only six issues.
Ugh, God, that's not fair. That's not fair. $6, that's fucking highway robbery.
I know, it's ridiculous. It is.
Oh, my goodness. That makes me sick to my stomach. Like, quite honestly, that is...
They're
like,
we know you'll do it.
Line.
We know you'll do it.
Ugh. No, that's the thing. I'm not going to do it. I'm not gonna. You can't make me do this, Marvel. I'm not doing it. That's all. I said this about Secret Wars.
How is it any different than buying, you know, the two Batman books a month? Because that totals to $6. It just feels better because you're throwing $3 at it at a time.
Here's the thing. Not gonna do it. Do that with
podcast
Batman.
Listeners, I'll leave it to you to go dig up the episodes where for several weeks Mike Rappin told us he was not going to read Civil War for different reasons.
He
was adamant about it, and he was very, very terse about it, and I'll leave it to you to find those because they're there. They're like seven audio samples.
Nick, you are and that's the thing, you are absolutely correct, and I am the first to admit I said for weeks I was not going to read Secret Wars, and then I caved and I totally did. The thing is, those were priced at a reasonable value, right? They were $4 a pop, which is what Marvel's across the board at
five?
This point.
The
first issue was $5. The last issue was $5, right? And that was $8. And this is out of 8 or 9 issues, I should say. But everything in the middle was $4. Like, it's reasonably priced as far as I'm concerned, right? And that's a lot of issues, right? That's 9 issues of comic books, and we're looking at crazy amounts of money regardless.
The Civil War
$6 oversized.
The first one was, but not by like the amount that would make you feel like it's worth $6 in my humble opinion.
Right.
Others might disagree,
but
at least it wasn't
sick.
Like DC Rebirth or I think it was the Batman Rebirth issue where it had like 4 pages of ads in a row, like that you thought, like, is the story done? Oh, just kidding, it's still going.
You're right.
So
those are my favorite points in DC Comics. I don't know why you're complaining. Like, that's my intermission.
Come visit all these shops that
that's
are you know, hundreds of miles from you.
DC knows when I get about 80% of the way through my book, I'm like, I just don't want this to end. And the DC's like, yeah, well, here's some fucking t-shirts and shoes for you to buy. And I was like, oh, thank God.
Yeah. Well, okay. Anyways, so what I read this week was not nearly as frustrating as whatever you just put me through with this Civil War II thing.
I think most people are just mad at themselves. They're not mad at Civil War II. They're just like, I can't believe I feel this way about Tony Stark. This is just infuriating.
Yeah. Anyways, I read 4001 AD number 2. I had same feelings as Nick. I also read the Exo Man of War, which I thought was a really cool way for them to fill in some backstory. I felt like it could have just been called 4001 AD, the timeline, and they didn't have to explain Exo Manowar, period, but hey, whatever. I'm enjoying this event. I did not think that I was going to be as into this and be willing to purchase all the side stories, but so far, I think I'm going to. Like, after just reading that Exo Manowar issue, I realized that there was a lot of really cool additive value that I really enjoy. I don't think you need it for the main story, but
as you definitely don't. I mean, yeah, we talked about
that's
this.
That's the best part. You don't need it. So, but as someone who read that Exo Manowar issue thinking, hey, I'll try it, I realized, oh, this is actually really cool as an extra thing, not necessarily required to the story. So I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, their one-shots, I've never seen a company really put so much care into their one-shots in terms of quality teams, in terms of filling in narrative holes, in terms of actually providing some additional content. But you're absolutely right. If you skipped that book and just read 4001 AD number 2, the preface in 4001 AD number 2 actually very briefly kind of fills in the little bits of information.
They give you enough information to say, just roll with this. I've told you the origin. If you want to read this extra book, you can, but it's not required by any means. Like, period. If that book never came out, you wouldn't lose any of the story.
Yeah.
Like, seriously, I think that's how you value whether something like that is required for the story. If it never came out, would you lose pieces of the story? And I absolutely think that you would not. So that was really cool about that. I read two Comixology submit books this week, trying to keep on my gonna keep reading all these books thing.
Sure.
I read Fez number 1. It was $1 for 12 issues. I guess what? I didn't realize that purchasing it, and it was like a prelude to a bigger story. And it seems like it's about this
12 issues or 12 pages. 12
pages. Yeah.
12 pages. It was 12 pages long.
Okay. That makes more sense.
So this I misspoke. Yeah. $1 for 12 pages. This book looks like it's a lot of fun. It's very simple in the way that, like, you know, old Archie comics are simple, or like a comic strip is simple. And I kind of liked it. It was very in your face, like 50s, 60s era spy story that just is gimmicky and like super campy. And it's very lighthearted. The art was very, very good. So there, it's on Comixology submit for $1. This Fez number 1 is FEZ. It's written and drawn by Roger Langridge. It's pretty cool. I also read a new number 1 that came out this recently. Fez number 1 came out a few years ago, I think, but Chunks number 1 is the other book that I read. Written and colored by Matt Garvey, with art by Christian Canfaya. I'm totally butchering that name, I'm sure. Essentially, it's written by a British guy about a punk band that's traveling in the United States. It's a really simple story. These guys it's a punk band that just gets into trouble, and I like it. That's like exactly what I want in like a fun, goofy comic book sometimes, and it totally like hit that like spot for me.
That's funny because that synopsis makes it sound exactly like Black Canary.
Yeah,
DCU,
I mean,
Black Canary, and that's not a bad thing.
But the thing is, there's no superheroes involved.
Okay, you're right. This book sounds like crap. Just go read Black Canary. I'm glad you covered that.
Yeah.
There's no canary cry going on. I'm just not interested.
Instead, there's miniature bearded sheriffs. So if you're into that,
that is one of my other favorite reading subgenres. So
I know.
When I go into Barnes & Noble, they're like, are you looking for teen supernatural romance? I'm like, no, I'm looking for small bearded sheriffs. Jesus.
Let's see. Anyways, so I read Snowfall number 4. This book continues to be incredibly confusing. We'll see if I actually follow it through the rest of the arc. I read Batman Rebirth number 1. And the only thing I want to say about this is whoever said Calendar Man isn't cool is the dumbest person in the entire world, because this issue was awesome. And if this is what, you know, Tom King is going to bring to Batman, I might consider reading this month-to-month stupid Batman series, but we'll see.
Oh, it's not month-to-month. It's shipping twice. Yeah.
Sorry, twice-a-month book. And the last thing I read was Scott Pilgrim Volume 3, because I'm still trying to power through the rest of that series because I have to talk about it with a bunch of people at work tomorrow. So I need to read 4, 5, and 6 tonight.
Oh, my God.
So that's
going
to be what I'm doing after the show tonight. So, moving on, we can actually talk about what we're excited for this upcoming week. And so I'll kick it back to Nick. What are you excited for this upcoming week?
I guess I would say that my pick for this week is 4001 AD Bloodshot number one, or Bloodshot number one colon 4001 AD, or just arrange those in the correct order.
Yeah.
And that's the name of the book. Colon slash semicolon parentheses enter the dragon.
Yeah.
I'm really excited for this book, especially because of the synopsis is sort of as follows. With their master long since gone, the microscopic machines that once drove Bloodshot through every firefight ... have one final directive to execute, but what could it possibly be? And this is really cool because they're actually building on the end of The Fall of Bloodshot, which was one of the one-shots used during the Book of Death event of last summer, where they sort of took a bunch of the characters and sort of showed their downfall or their end or their deaths flung far into the future as possible. And at the time, people said, well, like, these books are so far ahead of, you know, in time, could these events actually like matter? Could this actually be canon in some way, shape, or form?
Well, and I they mean, said, yeah. Well,
exactly.
They've got an actual comic book that's in the year 4001. So
right, and at that point, like, the 4001 universe was so underdeveloped that people were like, well, this is sort of a, you know, this stuff is never going to play, you know, come in, you know, play into things. But at the end of Fall of Bloodshot, minor spoilers, because like it was like a year ago, I don't care, I'm a rebel, he dies in the far-flung future when the nanites finally just wear out, or sort of begin to wholly decay. And apparently, from what little I've seen, this looks super fascinating, because it looks like, this is minor spoilers from the preview I read, I guess, the nanites construct a whole body for him, just made strictly of nanites, and it looks like sort of the Futurama thing where they've got the head in a glass jar. It looks like they found Bloodshot's head and attached it, and for some weird reason, they've got to get back to Earth. It looks like they're in New Japan, and he's got this final, the nanites have this final directive that has them heading to like New Moscow, and it's like, what's going on? This is really interesting. I'm really curious to see what this is about, because I think this is either going to somehow play into the sort of Soviet Valiant universe or potentially Bloodshot Island. So
Bloodshot
Island. And it's got Jeff Lemire and Doug Brathwaite, so it's the exact same team as the Fall of Bloodshot issue.
Right. That sounds... See, I'm probably going to buy this one, because all these little additive stories are really cool. But, hey. Kate, what are you excited for this upcoming week?
I'm looking forward to Wonder Woman Rebirth, because Greg Rucka is a god. I love his stuff. Batwoman Elegy is one of my favorite trades of all time. I've read a bunch of times. And then Black Magic and Lazarus and Queen and Country. He's done amazing stuff. I know he's been on Wonder Woman before, and I have not read any of that. So I am not the most informed enthusiast, obviously, but I'm looking forward to it nonetheless. And I also really miss the Wonder Woman in my life that used to be Brian Azzarello's Wonder Woman run until it got crappy and I fell off the wagon after, you know, several years. I think it was like volume 5 that I started going, oh, this used to be good. So I really want this to be awesome.
David Finch took over, I think. Didn't someone take over that book?
Yeah, towards the end, you got Meredith Finch writing and David Finch drawing.
Yeah, that was volume 7, but like 5 and 6 were still Azzarello, and they weren't anything to be too excited about.
Okay.
I mean, 5 was pretty good. 6 was... it's
also because Chiang was hopping on and off art at that point.
Exactly. Right. You got to keep milking that cash cow until it stops giving, and then kick it and milk it some more. And that's
welcome to American media,
right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So this I really want this one to be good.
Right? I know. Sorry.
So I have tempered hopes now for this, now that I've read DC Rebirth and the Batman Rebirth issue, but I'm still excited. How about you, Mike?
Oh, I'm just going to go right off the deep end and pick the craziest book that's going to be on the shelves this upcoming week. Renato Jones, The 1% Number 2. Number 1 was by far one of the craziest comics I've read in a long time in terms of action and story and what the fuckery. And that's like the only way I can describe it. Like, I'm really excited for this book, but I'm also really scared that reading this book makes me a bad person in some way.
It puts you on some government list, like a watch list.
Yeah. Or maybe, like, I feel like there's going to be something revealed in this book that is not going to sit well with a lot of people, and I'm going to be like, oh, this is so cool. And then people are going to be like, Mike's the guy that really likes that Renato Jones book. Should we talk to him anymore? So
yeah,
I'm still on board. I really love Kyle Andrews. Everything that he did on Iron Fist was magnificent and beautiful. So I want to trust him. And I think a lot of the like crazy angles he took in the first issue of Renato Jones was actually really good. I think he did a lot of really good work with like experimental art in his specific form. And I like that he's totally owning the fuck out of this book. Like he is saying, this is my book. I created it. I'm really proud of this. Like the work that I'm doing is my greatest work yet. And to that, I have to like applaud the guy. And I want to keep reading until it eventually or maybe even possibly becomes a book that I'm not enjoying anymore. So, and I say eventually because I think a lot of times these types of books, like they grind me down and eventually I'm like, okay, I'm really rubbed the wrong way about this. I don't want to read it. But hopefully number two will, you know, tone it down a little bit on the crazy scale. Maybe number one was like at 11 because it needed to be. And number two will actually get into some of the more serious story that's going on because this is all just a big fuck you to corporate overlords and one percenters and all that jazz. So it's wild. It's going to be insane. I'm certain of it.
It's always fascinating when you have a creator who is largely known for their, you know, big two work. And they've got this singular voice and this singular style, and especially in the case of Andrew, someone who's writing and drawing and also, you know, doing the covers, this sort of singular vision.
Yeah.
And it's always interesting when you take them outside of the big two and you sort of wonder, was the big two or whatever, was this pre-established character the thing that was keeping them from being batshit insane? Or was it the thing that was holding them back from, you know, providing some pure, unadulterated look at their soul or psyche, you know? Because with people like Alish Kott, for me, like the big two is his, or even, you know, including Valiant, that was like sort of his one handle in like the realm of like reality and normal life. And I think that made his writing, you know, something that I was okay with. And then when he went off and did Zero and everything, I was like, okay, buddy, like I think someone needs to like shackle you back to reality. So,
well, it's funny. Because you see characters or you see writers in artists even that get, you know, they're held down by the constraints of a character or a, you know, a franchise that they're working on, and right. So they can't get too crazy out there because they do have to, like, they're grounded in some way. And so when you let creators like this go and do their own thing, and I'm going to point out Rick Remender because I think he was the best example.
I was going to completely go with.
He's the example that I think I really loved his big two work, and I like some of his independent work, but I think the longer and longer he's gotten away, or the further and further he's gotten away from the big two, the crazier his work has gotten, and the less I like it. And yep. That's really unfortunate because I think that guy can create magnificent stories. He's such a fantastic writer, but his independent work just does not do it for me. While it does for others, there are people who are diehards for Rick Remender and have been since Fear Agent back at Dark Horse that he did, but I've always felt that his big two work was better, and that maybe because I'm biased, like I really like the characters that he was working with, but ultimately his stuff like Deadly Class, Black Science, and Low, I just could not get into them. And that might just be me, and I just love his Uncanny X-Force, and that's probably because I'm incredibly biased, but the guy's he did a fantastic job. He did stuff with X-Men that people haven't done in years or haven't been as like out there to try new exciting stories that are really dark but also super meaningful. So I mean, I don't know. I realize you were going to say this, something similar, Nick, probably.
Well, yeah. I mean, Marvel kept him from reaching that sort of peak level of sexy violent that something like Tokyo Ghost is just so rife with.
right.
And yeah, he's one of the weird examples. I think the general trend is, oh man, the big two, you know, big brother on my back, keeping me down, keeping me from reaching my pure creative potential. And sometimes it's like, you know what? Sometimes it pays to have an editor who's like, you know what? You can't fucking put that in a comic book. Like three straight pages of, you know, G-strings is not is not pushing this narrative to any new point. I'm sorry. It's exactly. not happening. Who Kate, knows?
I feel like you feel the same way about this
No,
as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I could not agree more about this. Yeah, it's some people need editors reining them back, and he definitely feels like one of them because sexy violence doesn't work for me.
Yeah, I mean, we're not necessarily trying to harp on Rick Remender, but I think he just happens to be an
example. He's just a really good mainstream example.
We wouldn't be so mad about this if it wasn't for the fact that at some point he gave us stuff that we were actually happy
exactly.
with. End of story.
Yeah, that's true.
So
Secret Avengers was great.
I don't like their independent stuff because of that stuff, but then their Big Two stuff is also not that great, so it's not the same issue. It's his thing is, like, he could be really good when he's tempered, but he needs that little help.
And then right. it's just funny that, like, I think a week ago on Twitter, he's like, guess what? As of today, I've written the last issue that was contractually binding me to anything, and I'm free yeah. as whatever now. And I'm like, all right, this is not having the sort of reception from me that I think you wanted it to. Like, you just basically said, write me off.
Yeah.
Sorry. So it's still to be seen if that's the way that that Andrews will go with Renato Jones.
I mean, sure.
Fingers crossed that it won't go too off the deep end. But after the end of issue one, I think we're already there. So let's see how
You're
long
already
I'm actually,
in the deep end. Yeah.
I was going to say, like, let's not count him out. But then Mike is like, I think we've already reached that point. Issue one came and went, and we're there.
Yeah.
This week our topic is graphic novel adaptations of books and are they ever worthwhile, which right there should give you an idea of our bias going into this.
No, we're not biased. No.
Oh, come on. We were totally biased.
I wrote the question in a bad mood, okay? I was hungry.
Okay. Mike was in a bad place. He's feeling better now.
Yeah,
but anyway,
absolutely.
I definitely had not read any, like it never was the type of thing that grabbed my attention on the shelf. But I went ahead and used our Michigan Interlibrary Loan System and ordered a whole bunch to be sent to my library. And so in the process of doing that, I ended up reading four of them. And afterwards, in retrospect, when I was taking notes, I noticed that I also only snagged graphic novels of books I had already read, which probably says something about my own. I just want people to read the books first because I think books are so valuable. But that being said, the four I grabbed were A Game of Thrones Volume 1, which I think is probably one of the most popular adaptation series right now.
Totally.
And I think that's pretty purely based off of the overall Game of Thrones fandom. The Graveyard Book Volume 1, which, as far as I can tell, was not serialized. It was published in volumes. So there's multiple volumes for the one book, but it came out a graphic novel at a time. And The Hobbit, the Illustrated Edition, which takes you way back, that one came out in 1989 as an OGN.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which was an interesting look at how they've changed over the decades. And then I also grabbed Howl, the graphic novel. It's a graphic novelization of Allen Ginsberg's classic poem. And yeah, so that was kind of the spread I was working with. And so the answer to the question I came up with was a very qualified yes. So yes, if done well.
Yeah.
So it's easier to start with the what was really bad and made me cringe so hard is why
yeah, go for it.
So Howl, the graphic novel, is like should not exist. I'm sorry. It's so bad.
Oh,
so
man.
This is an amazing classic poem, right? And then the graphic novel, it's the same text. Like they didn't change the poem at all. But what they do is break up this one poem that's like part of the reason it's so famous is for its incredible flow and rhythm. And they break it up into these tiny bite-sized chunks over what, like 200 some pages. And then it's like spoon feeding it to you with this really simplified imagery when that's the other thing that this poem is so incredible for is it's really complex and deep imagery that's emotional, not just visual. And instead of getting that, you, I mean, like, technically, yes, you could read the words and ignore the art, but then what's the point of the graphic novel? And so if you're looking at the art on the page instead of coming up with your own images for this, it is just, it takes this incredible work and just dummies it down. And yet, like, some the big argument for a lot of these classic works with graphic novels and dumbing it down is, yeah, okay, then it makes it more accessible for younger kids. It's a good entry point. But this isn't an entry point for kids. This is still Howl. It's still really R-rated. And the art makes it even more R-rated. This is not for children. So that was a perfect example, I thought, of when they should not exist, you know, when you're just dumbing it down for no reason. And
right. So yeah. In the case of something like Howl, was the idea to not necessarily make a comic book, but make a picture book for children? Because, I mean, I think in some ways it sounds
very adult. I mean, you have like a forest of penises at one point. So I think the way this one actually got made in this case was there was that Allen Ginsberg movie. And then in it, there's this digital art version of his poem. And then that same artist made this graphic novel. And I think it was mostly just a merchandise thing, like sell more stuff. But I can here to tell you right now, the art is terrible. It's terrible in the movie. It's terrible in the graphic novel. So it's not even good art that's dumbing it down. It's bad art. There's just, everything about this was just like throw it on the floor and get it out of my sight. Like,
right. So in a lot of cases, I think that's probably what we'll see. You'll see sometimes with graphic novel adaptations of books is it's simply a merchandising thing where they're trying to just sell more versions of this story.
Oh, yeah.
And in the case of something like The Hobbit, maybe that's not necessarily, that is the case simply because The Hobbit is a singular book that's been around for I don't even know how many years. And so to add like an illustrated edition just for some people adds value to it. It allows them to have an easier entry point for someone who may not be interested in The Hobbit because it's fantasy and it's dragons and dwarves. And in the case of, you know, this series, this is usually, I think a lot of people will actually read this book to their children, which I think is super interesting because to me, The Hobbit feels like...
You're talking about The Hobbit and not
The
Howl,
Hobbit.
Right?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I am talking about The Hobbit.
Gather around, kids.
Because The Hobbit is very much it's just an adventure story. It's about, you know, it's a series of whimsical adventure. And I think adding pictures to a book like this make it even more accessible for younger readers.
Yeah, Hobbit is definitely like Harry Potter, where the story can be enjoyable to kids much younger than have the reading comprehension to read it themselves. The illustrated edition makes it so kids the age to enjoy it can also read it to themselves. And so this is one example of where it would be a good entry point where you could read this when you're 7 or 8, and then you could actually read the book itself when you're, you know, 9 or 10, because it is a lower reading level. The big thing that this is a kind of in-between book for me, not an example of, wow, this is how to do it. Because the watercolor art, it's all ink and watercolors, and it is so beautiful, and you could have it just as a collector's item just for that, and I think a lot of people do based on, you know, Amazon and eBay searches. The big thing that makes it so much easier to read is they take out all of the inner dialogue, all of Bilbo's thinking to himself, all of that is just gone. You have dialogue between characters, and then every now and then you have a dialogue box that is to explain plot. But everything else, all the inner action is gone. I mean, maybe you see it visually. Like, that's, I guess, the point of a visual medium is you get it in the visual. But in that way, it makes it significantly easier to read and more simplified, so that it's a very straightforward, no depth type adventure story.
Right.
And it's beautiful and it's fun. And if I was 8 years old, this would probably be the favorite thing on my shelf. So I think that's a good example of an entry point. And it's very, like, the art style is very fanciful. Like the, if you think about like what a late 80s fanciful, like, fantasy art looks like, that's this book. So it's so nostalgic. Then the Graveyard Book is another one where I think, at least from The Hobbit and the Graveyard Book compared to the other two, it feels like children's books may suit this better than other, like, adult books, just because they're easier to, they're less complex. And the more inner stuff you have going on in a book, because that's the big difference, right, with books versus the visual, is you can have all that interaction and the, you know, omniscient narrator and everything. And when you don't have so much of that in children's books, you're not losing so much. And when you have all these monsters and it's mostly plot driven, like external action, you can show that visually much easier. So the Graveyard book, I thought, worked really well as a graphic novel. It came out in 2014, so it's a fairly recent thing. I mean, the book itself didn't come out that long ago either. This is Neil Gaiman, if you didn't know.
Okay.
Who is awesome, and I love him, which is why I had read a book, even though it's a children's book. I read all his stuff that comes out. They chose, even though it's a graphic, not like came out by volume, each chapter is a different artist, which normally I have a big problem with, but honestly, it seems like they tried to draw pretty similarly to each other, because I didn't even realize that until I was like halfway through the book.
Wait, is it each volume has a different artist?
No, each chapter of the volume, yeah. So I think this is, again, is when you have more monsters and creatures and that kind of stuff, it's cool to see the art, and it works pretty well. And again, it's an easier reading level even than the book, and the book is a children's book, but I think it's technically YA, but it's easier than that because it's mostly dialogue and cuts out a lot of the inner stuff. Where Game of Thrones is the great example of they obviously chopped massive amounts of inner stuff, because that's like the bulk of the, 700 pages of some of these books is inner turmoil. But they still leave in a ton of it in the graphic novel. So, or comics. This one is serialized. I don't know if it's still going. It's a 24-issue for the first book.
It's done.
Okay. So it was
They stopped after the end.
Yeah, it was 4 trade paperbacks over 2 years, so it was 24 issues, and they, like, when they signed on the artist and the writer and stuff, they contracted them for 2 years to do an issue a month for two years, which I think is pretty intense. And so what I thought was really interesting is so I got it obviously as a volume from the library, and the front of the jacket, right when you have the very intro to it, it says the first line is, "You've read the books, you've watched the hit series on HBO and then goes into like why you should read this. So it was assuming that you were already a fan of both. Yeah, exactly. And so that's when we're talking about like things just being money grabs and for merchandising, I think this fits that bill like to the T.
Yeah. This is for those diehard Game of Thrones people that are like, I need to have
can't get enough.
Every recreation of this story.
Right, exactly. I need it in every medium possible. And they had Alex Ross covers for a lot of them, that were really beautiful. And so I definitely would see where they'd be good collector's items. The really interesting thing I thought was that they, even though the show was adapting from the books into visual medium, the comic was completely separate from that process. So they are both taking the same source material and turning it to a visual medium, but they didn't do it together. So they make a lot of really similar or the same choices, like a lot of the same scenes and characters get cut because it's pretty obvious that, I mean, if you read the books, some of the fat, if you will, is pretty clear that this is the stuff that could get trimmed, and they both did that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they make some different choices, which I think is really interesting. Like, there is a scene between Arya and Sansa before Sansa starts mooching with Joffrey and, like, sucking up to him in Winterfell. There's a scene between Arya and Sansa that is really significant to both their characters in the book, and was actually the scene that they used to cast both actresses for their roles, because it's such a good interaction between them and dynamic, if you will. And then they cut it from the show for length, and so it's not in the show and it's in the comic, and that was an interesting choice. And there's some other things, some other characters that stay in or aren't in, and scenes that get left out or brought in, that different choices. But it is, Nick and I were talking about it as we were both reading it, and it is remarkably similar. Like, you would almost, unless you read the thing, if you weren't kind of comparing side by side, you'd think, oh, they went right off the show, like word for word. But part of that is because they both stuck really, really true to the dialogue of the book.
Right.
And so the wording is identical for like the speech bubbles versus the show script, you know?
That's the thing that's really interesting about that series in particular, is how much they tried to actually pull from the books.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, the writer, and so there's tons of back material in these volumes, and the writer talks about his process, and he said he would read, so when he got the assignment, right, he divvied up the one, because they're just doing the one first novel, and he divvied it up into the 24 issues, what section of the book was each issue kind of thing. And then before writing the script for each issue, he said he read that section 5 times to get it down and like figure everything out. And then the artist said he'd read that section once and then read the script a couple times and all the notes and everything. So it's like, yeah, they were hardcore to the source material. And then the producers of Game of Thrones have said the same kind of stuff.
Gotcha. Yeah, so this is kind of a, I think we put ourselves at like a very interesting impasse where we say, you know, sometimes things are done really, really poorly if they're done for merchandising, which is kind of the mentality that I had when, you know, writing this question down was, you know, we talked in another episode about, you know, the comic book adaptations of movies or kind of like the franchising of movies in comic books. And here we're seeing a similar thing with books here, but it sounds to me like maybe these are just the books that you chose, but it sounds like that these can actually work. I can only say that I've only read a handful of book adaptations book adaptations as graphic novels, mostly books that I've actually read before. I've never picked up something and go, oh, you know, I've been meaning to read this book. Yeah. So why don't I read the comic book version of it first? And all of the book adaptations that I've read before have been okay. Like specifically, I'm thinking the Dresden Files book series and the Game of Thrones series that you guys have been talking mm-hmm. about. And I've never thought that they were great. I just thought that they were okay. So I don't know. I'm still stuck. Like, are they ever worthwhile? I'm not really sure. Is it an easy way to introduce someone to a series? Maybe. I don't know. It sounds to me like Nick, you and Kate have read a little bit more than I have.
Well, I think it's interesting that, I don't know about you, maybe Nick has read stuff that he hasn't read the book of first, but I think it's very interesting and telling that none of us picked up stuff that we hadn't read the book of.
Oh, no, it's definitely true. I mean, for example, I really, really love Parker by Darwin Cook. Surprise, notice the theme.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I guess I've read that as well.
And Parker is obviously based on a series of books by Donald Westlake. And I can't remember if Westlake is the pen name or the actual author's name. I think Richard Starking is the pen name. Westlake is the author. Who cares? Long story short, I think that's a great example of a book where if you would have ever said, hey, Nick, are you ever going to sit down and read this crime novel from the 1960s? Like, do you know anyone who's going to recommend a book like this to you? Do you run in the sorts of circles where this sort of book is popular? The answer is a resounding no to all of that. But because it was, hey, it's a graphic novel, it's from a publisher I really like, it's with a creator that I respect, this guy mm-hmm. has a great background, he apparently, this means a great deal to him because he decided that he was going to adapt it on his own and he got the blessing of the original writer. So all of that said to me, hey, you've never read the original book, and maybe you don't have to, and maybe, based on the content, based on the general theme, maybe you wouldn't even actually like that, but do you actually want to try the graphic novel? And I said, yeah, absolutely, and Parker is fantastic. And I even went back a couple days ago, this is how dedicated I am, just kidding, it's not that tough, I have Google. I went and looked up the 20-page... I told you guys, it's not, you know, I'm not really sweating it over here to get this stuff done. I just Google stuff and then click, you know, do you want to read the sample? That's, it's tough. So I read the sample, which is the first two chapters of Parker, and it only gives you a newfound respect, really, for what he was doing. Because for the first 9 pages of the novel, there is no dialogue in this book. There is no dialogue in Parker. And I think what makes it even more fascinating is that Parker is a book that's also not written from the first-person perspective, which I think was something Kate was getting at earlier, was how do you handle these books that frequently, I think in the case of Kate, she was talking about The Hobbit, how do you deal with these books that have a narration or tend to have a heavy narration throughout the entire book?
Right.
And of course, the problem is with comic books, the thought bubble, as Paul said weeks and weeks and weeks ago, see Paul, I pay attention. you know, the thought bubble has gone the way of the dinosaurs. The thought bubble is dead for good reason. It's annoying as fuck and it ruins pacing and it rarely ever is utilized anymore. That's not to say that the captions that have replaced it haven't been as equally annoying, but the thought bubble's largely gone. So how do you adapt a book with that sort of narration? Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's a struggle. But with Parker, it's a book where you have a character that rarely ever talks. He's not the real talkative sort. He's more of the punchy, punchy, stabby, stabby.
Right.
And you can't rely on him giving you his inner thoughts because quite simply they're not there in the book. So you would either have to either do an injustice to the source material and fabricate an entire inner monologue that was never in the original source, or you're just going to have to rely on telling a story about a character through pictures. And I think that's what's so great about, you know, Parker, is that you just follow him around through town. And if you read the novel, you sort of understand that, you sort of get into his head and you see like why he's doing all these things, how he's managing to forge this driver's license and how he's tricking the bank into, you know, pretending. And I never even paid attention to this, but if you're reading the graphic novel, there's a certain point, and maybe it's just me not being observant, which I feel like is my number one excuse on this podcast. there's a point where he goes into the bank and they're like, we don't have anyone here named Howard Johnson. Like, sorry, buddy. There's no one with accounts here by that name. And then it just shows the bank continually telling him like it's not going to work. And then in the final panel on the page, it goes, okay, well, we found Howard Johnson. Here's your account numbers. And I wasn't paying attention because I thought, why is the bank suddenly saying like everything's good? And yet if you pay attention in the panels, and it's not always in the same spot, there's a little sign for the bank that sort of indicates that he's going to different banks.
Yeah, yeah. Oh.
And each one's turning him down.
Yeah.
And if you read the novel, it's very clear. You know, they explain, you know, he went to this bank, and then he went to that bank, and then he went to that bank. And so here you have Darwin Cook just silently putting everything into play without having to, you know, come up with new dialogue for the book or things like that. And I think adaptations like that are great because, first off, like I said, it gets people to actually engage with the source material or a story or a narrative that they likely wouldn't otherwise read. And in the case of something like Parker, you get to see someone at the top of their game really challenging themselves to, transform something that doesn't have a narration, doesn't have characters that talk a lot. How in the world are you going to turn this into a graphic novel? You've already got, you know, you already don't have a first person narration and you don't have dialogue to push this book as much as you could with other books. Mm-hmm. How are you going to do it? So something like that is a great example for me.
Yeah, prose to visual, whether it's TV, movie, or comics, is always hard for that kind of reason. But I think comics especially, because it's static images and you don't have the soundtrack. So like a really good example from Game of Thrones would be when Jon Snow has told his family he's joining the Night's Watch and is leaving Winterfell. It's this really big thing for him in the books. And it's he has all this inner dialogue in the books about how torn he is and how upset and how scared and all this stuff. And in
spoilers
the show,
for
they,
chapter one of Game of Thrones.
Well, yeah,
by the way.
Come on. Have you been living under a rock? Okay.
I'm kidding.
So in the show, they have him, you know, he's walking down the stairwell or whatever, and it's Kit Harington's face is kind of showing all these emotions, but you also have this big swelling of music that gives you that same mood. And so you can really feel how torn he is about this and how it's his choice, but he's really upset and he's being kind of forced into it and all that stuff. Where in the comic, it's three, you know, static panels and they're trying to show it with his face, but there's like, if you didn't know this already, there's no way you would have gotten that from these books, from the comic.
That guy really can't draw faces either.
Well, yeah, that's true, yeah, that's too. True. I was not a huge fan of the art style and the comics for this, but some people are. Some people, apparently, according to the internet, can't get enough of the way he draws these characters.
Yeah.
But he talked about how he purposely did them differently from the actors and actresses and stuff. But they turned out really cartoony.
Yeah.
Fit the tone of the book at all. So
in the art of Game of Thrones, specifically Volume 1, everyone's face looks extra bubbly. Like they all look
and
like,
all the female faces look so much alike. Yeah.
They have you? I don't know if you guys have ever seen like Fraggle Rock or read any of the,
yes,
any of the Muppet.
If you
comic
look at the
books,
shine in like the horse's eyes, it looks like Lisa Frank. Mm-hmm. The art looks mm-hmm. like Lisa Frank.
Yeah. And it's like kudos to him for how detailed everything is. Like when you have these big open scenes with all the different like hundreds of people in a courtyard kind of thing, it's really impressive. Yeah. But yeah, it's not for me. It's definitely for some people.
The horse that Daenerys gets looks straight out of Lisa Frank.
Yeah, no, I wasn't going to say no it, idea but what there that you is, go.
But okay.
What? Okay, maybe it's before your time.
It is before like, my time, remember,
like,
I guess.
Lisa Frank, where it's like purple and pink and rainbows and sparkles and unicorns and shiny.
Oh,
really?
Okay, there we go. You said Trapper Keeper. You got me.
Yep.
Okay, so... This is. I think we're still at this impasse, though. Are these novels, like, are they worthwhile? Because of course, as every episode where I come on with a very strong opinion, my opinion suddenly changes as I start to remember things because I'm apparently
Secret Wars.
I'm like, you know, a 27-year-old forgets everything type of
soon
old
to be
man.
Civil War II.
So the thing is. I read The Hedge Knight, which is an adaptation of a novella that George R. R. Martin wrote that is a supplemental story to the Game of Thrones mythos, right?
I love those stories.
And actually, yeah, I really like those stories because I ended up reading the actual books. But before I read the books, I did read The Hedge Knight, right?
Okay.
So I read the graphic novel adaptation of The Hedge Knight, and I really enjoyed it. And I was like, this is really cool. I really like getting into the Game of Thrones mythos. I never actually would have read those novellas. Well, let me take a step back. I never would have read those novellas until I heard that they tied into something that Maester Aemon was muttering about in book 4, but I'm not going to get into that. But I don't think I would have read those
books.
Took
the words right out of my mouth.
And I don't think I would have had a tie-in to understand what Maester Aemon was babbling on about in book 4 had I not read The Hedge Knight and heard about Duncan Egg and
so
those
what
two
it
characters.
So was it like going the other direction there, starting at comics and then reading the books?
Well, of course, I ended up having visuals in my head of what these characters looked like already. And so I was a little, like, kind of bummed about that because, you get an image of a character in your head and sometimes it's not what ends up being portrayed in the movie or in the comic book or whatever.
Right.
And it's just like Harry Potter. Like, I had these very distinct images in my head when I read the Harry Potter books. And then as soon as the movies came out, I was like, well... Hermione Granger doesn't look like that in my head. Her hair is supposed to be
bushy hair and buck teeth. Come on,
frizzier.
Emma Watson.
Don't get me wrong. I really love the portrayal. To this day, now all of those characters have morphed into the actors in my head. So when I reread the series, now all I can see is fucking Daniel Radcliffe screwing everything up.
It's true.
But yeah, so it was an interesting thing to say. Of course, now I'm actually thinking, The Hedge Knight was a good way for me to say, oh, I could read more George R. R. Martin other than just the Game of Thrones, primary series. Those supplemental novels were actually really good and the stories were interesting. And it was because of comics, the adaptation that I actually read them. And I think the same goes for something like the Dark Tower series that I know a lot of people are fans of. They love the comic books and they also love the books. So I can't say that I've read any of those. I mean, I did read one or two issues of one of the first Dark Tower prequel comics that are, brand new stories written by Peter David and, when he hung out with Stephen King. But I don't know. I think those types of things actually draw people back into books because it's like, oh, I'll read the easy version of this story. And then they're like, wait, I actually really like this. I want to read the full story now. So I don't know. At least that's how it worked for me. So I don't know. Have you guys had that experience at all with anything? Or were these your first tries in the adaptation, realm outside of Parker?
Well, yeah, there's definitely another one that I tried a couple days ago. I downloaded via the Boom Bundle the Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep novelization, which was obviously also better known for some people as Blade Runner by Philip K. Dick. And what's resoundingly weird about this, and I can't remember which one Kate was saying, I think it was probably Howl, which Howl makes sense because it's just a poem, so you can get away with making it, I don't know what you want to call it, unabridged, where you have all of the words. But literally, it has all of the novel, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? The whole thing is written out within this book. It is 642 pages of comics.
Even the narration? Like...
All of it. Holy Believe cow. Me, Mike, it drove me crazy. I went and I looked up, again, the things I do for this show, I can't state this enough, 24/7, 365, during leap years 366, I went and looked up the first chapter of, because that's all Google's going to give me, because they're being dicks, I went up and looked up the first chapter of Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, and literally every single word every single word, every dialogue, every description, literally every single word from the book is in the graphic novel, which I think they technically called it something different because it's not really an adaptation. It literally is, the entire
illustrated
book.
Version of the book. But to me, that makes me
think, sure. It's one of those, you know, the books. The Hobbit, it says illustrated edition.
Yeah. When you look at the credits for this book, it does not say illustrated and adapted by. It just says this book was written by Philip K. Dick and it was drawn by this dude.
Wow.
He has a name though, I don't remember. And oh my goodness, first off, like, pacing issues are insane. It is so slow.
Yeah.
And all of the panels are so busy and so full because they're just covered with these huge text bubbles. I couldn't even get far enough to figure out where it started to resemble Blade Runner.
There was a period of time, and I don't know when, I'd have to double check, but there was a time when they were doing a whole bunch of these graphic novel or comic versions of sci-fi books.
Most Lovecraft has had this treatment, which I need to credit.
Lovecraft,
most of the Lovecraft,
Philip K.
I think,
Dick,
is Ian J. Colbert.
A lot of Isaac Asimov got this. All the really prolific sci-fi authors that were really popular at the time, they're like, let's make more money. So,
yeah.
But then when the art is good, it works, you know? So I think that's another element is you can't say they have no value because you're adding, or like the Hobbit art is so beautiful, you don't care about the rest of it. And so...
But it starts to abuse the medium.
It
and this
does,
goes back
yeah.
to that whole discussion Mike and I had about redundancy.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
the value of, you know, learning how to properly read comics and learning how to properly perceive comics. And a lot of times a well-written, quote-unquote, a well-written script, unquote, creates this visual redundancy between the art and the writing. And of course, when you literally have the whole damn novel there,
yeah,
there's going
you don't
to be
need
a metric fuck ton
of redundancy.
The description
of the panel in front of you, yeah.
Yeah, I actually wanted to ask you that, Nick. How did the art deal with descriptions in the text?
Well, a lot of times they were careful to some respects, they were careful to not create a full-on redundancy. Like, maybe the art would cover something slightly described in the panel, but they would at least not make it like, you know, blow for blow, like the guy walked into the room and you see him walk into the room and then he, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about.
But it's just unavoidable that quite literally when you have the entire book, you're going to create these redundancies. And don't get me wrong, I think it's really interesting that they injected the whole work there. Because I guess maybe for some people, they're always like, well, I want to know what was left out, or I know that compromises were being made, and I'm suspicious about what they were. And so set your, you know, fears at bay, because here's the whole book.
That's
but pacing-wise, at least for me, like, and I'm sure it is for you guys as well, like, there's a certain reading speed and a pacing speed that I keep in my head when I read comics or I read graphic novels. And sure, it varies all over the place. When I'm reading Five Ghosts, I'm going probably as fast as I can because that book is paced at a certain speed that it works.
Yeah.
And if I'm reading something by Jonathan Hickman, you know, we dial it back to one, but there's still a range, right?
Yeah,
right.
And
yeah.
then, but with something like this, it's like so far outside of my range that I'm like, this is like, if this is the reading speed I'm going at, just remove the visuals because it's actually getting me frustrated at this point.
You say, you're definitely slowing down to a pace where that you might as well just read the prose and give up on the comic art. You just want,
you know, like, what I was thinking to myself as I read it is like, you know how some books have it, especially like older children's books, where you read 7 or 8 pages and then there's like that full color drawing.
This is exactly what I was about to try to get to, but yes, please continue.
Yeah, it's like every 7 or 8 pages, there's this full color drawing with like an old fashioned caption underneath it. So you're like, oh, this is supposed to be that moment that, you know, happened a couple pages ago. Like, that was really well paced. Mm-hmm.
That's how I read some of the old Huck Finn stories, I think.
Yeah.
Was
sure.
with a version like that where it was.
There was the Junior Library Illustrated Edition.
And it was like, we're just going to occasionally, every once in a while, check in with you to make sure your imagination didn't really fucking go off the rails. Like, this should look like this. This guy should look like this. Don't forget, this guy's not too tall.
This is the fence that they painted, and
this
is how
the fence.
Huck Finn...
It should be 80% white.
Right.
A lot of them had really beautiful oil paintings. And
absolutely. No, not to discount the
art. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
But they definitely tried to make sure that you were imagining a specific style or a specific way that a character should be perceived or a city should be viewed or the angle at which, you know, when the character was
imagination should
something.
Be restrained right. and checked yeah. whenever possible.
But really. Or enhanced. Come on. That's one of the things that you gain as a reader skill. You get better and better at holding images in your head. So little yeah. kids, that's really good to have these constant refreshers and stuff that helps in the reading process, which is why you get illustrated editions for kids.
But I think this actually kind of... it kind of damages like the view of comic books in a way then, right? When you think about, mm-hmm. oh, the way, pretty much just the way that you described it, Kate, where like sometimes kids need this encouragement and they need help, you know, visualizing something.
Right.
And so a lot of people will go, well, comic books are just books that you need help visualizing. And it's like, listen to
nah,
me,
they're,
you
they're
son
more
of a bitch.
They're more similar to movies in my opinion. Like they're quicker paced and they give you the visuals and...
And the visual is part of the storytelling medium,
exactly.
Right?
It's built in, as opposed, which is why the Android's Dream of Electric Sheep thing makes no sense to me. Why you would
yeah,
have
that,
both the description and the art?
That blows
that seems
my
so
mind.
A silly idea, but
yeah.
I also kind of wonder, like, do you guys think the art is as valuable when they're going off of someone else's description, like they're going based off of the description in the book versus coming up with their own unique? I guess coming up with an original character concept design versus going off of what someone else describes. Do you think it's...
I think that there's some value there. I think, you know, like I said with the Harry Potter movies, right? Like I had mm-hmm. these images in my head of what these characters look like. And I mean, they're still there, but seeing how someone else interpreted that is always really cool. Like there's no way for you and I to be able to say, well, what were you thinking? What were you, how were you picturing
right.
it? And you use the same words that the author originally used. And it's like, okay, well, when you say, you know, frizzy brown hair for Hermione, you and I have totally different pictures in our heads. But the, you know, the advantage of comic books and movies is that you can actually see how that person interpreted that look or that description.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think that's the cool part about this.
Well,
is
especially for comics, they can draw it exactly versus going off of an actress's face. Like that
yeah,
you're not,
yeah.
you don't have a built-in thing. So like, yeah.
It's really interesting.
There's definitely value to be had in seeing someone's artistic
rendition,
unique artistic interpretation
yeah.
of a work that you've maybe already experienced yourself. I think the issue for me with some of these things, and of course this is art, so maybe this is the worst question in the world to be asking, one of utility, but the question for me with a lot of these is like, who is this for?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
who is this meant for? Like, the Game of Thrones one, like, it destroys my mind thinking about, like, who is the ideal audience
oh,
for this?
Oh, but
Nick,
because it says right
when
in
you look
the book
at when it,
that they
yeah.
are
yes.
expecting you to be a super fan. You've read the books and you've watched
yep.
the show. This is that is who it's
yeah.
for. It is for people who have
it's like already instructing
it
you.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, is this you? Is this you?
Maybe.
Well, then you have no choice.
You're, that's right.
This,
give us your
we've
money.
Dictated your
think,
life for you.
I think, though, that might be taking that description at face value, because maybe
yeah.
you know, and this is me in a weird hypothetical world, you know, someone who's like, well, I don't want to read Game of Thrones and I don't like TV, so but I
mm-hmm.
do read comic books, and then your friend who got you at Secret Santa goes, well, I don't know what to get Mike, and and then someone goes, well, he likes comics, look, there's an adaptation of this series that I think he might like, but he won't read the book because they're too long, maybe I'll give him volume one, and if he likes that, then maybe he'll keep reading it, or he'll switch over and actually read the books now that he's given it a chance.
Yeah.
You know, I think sometimes these adaptations can be
a
you
gateway
know,
drug.
Yeah, well, they're like a way to pique someone's or you know, give someone an insight into a series that they maybe wouldn't try because comics are quote unquote easier to read in some ways. And when
yeah.
they're adaptations like this, they usually are easier to read in compared to the actual book, you know, with this
oh, yeah.
with this Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep being the only exception, I think. So it's I think it's a, like you said, it's a gateway drug. It's a way to get someone interested without you know, pushing an entire book series on them.
Yeah.
I mean, Mike, I recently began watching Jurassic Park, which makes me feel qualified to discuss chaos theory
yes,
at length.
Yes.
But, you know, the probability of the sequence of events you just described happening is well, just throw in your own Jeff Goldblum laugh at this point,
yeah.
because that's really how I feel about it. I think, I don't know, it's really strange to me because like if the Game of Thrones comic comes out, and presumably, you know, this is months after the shows, like what sort of position are you at where you don't want to read the books, which a lot of people don't want to read books, I get that, and you don't want to see the show, which is kind of weird, and yet somehow you're interested in the comic, or alternatively, you've seen the show, which was your compromise for not having read the books, and now you've decided you want to read the comic?
Yeah, it's a merchandising thing. It's a
it is.
Get
it's
another
for the people
interpretation.
Who are buying everything Game of Thrones. And you've got to admit, there's a large crossover in audience demographic of comic buyers and Game of Thrones fans. Yeah. So this is why you can buy all the figurines at your comic shop.
It really seems like this is just like super fan market.
Yeah.
Like, it's either the super fan market or it's the people who... This is like the only ideal person I think who fits this mold is the person who wants to be confident about lying about having read the books.
But it wouldn't work because it came out so far after the
show.
The episodes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and then they read the comic and they're like, oh shit, this is exactly like the TV show. So when I lie about saying I read the books, I'm probably actually
the same
fucked.
Scenes pretty much.
Because
you are an unconvincing liar. That's what, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, like I said, like, this is all art, obviously, although we can make the joke about, is it really art? But, so the question of utility is something that maybe shouldn't even be discussed, but for me, with a lot of these, it's like, is this for something other than making money? And I'm sure some cynic would be like, well, Nick, isn't Parker for making money? You know, isn't it just for generating more money? And for me, like, Parker, like I said, is this obscure, semi-obscure series of crime novels that did win awards back in the day and were popular back in the day. But for me, Cook was doing much more of a service of bringing something to light that, like, nobody had heard of. Whereas Game of Thrones, like, no one needed to be told what Game of Thrones
right,
was,
right?
It's
right.
Like...
I do want to say...
Remember that show with the boobs? What,
yeah, yeah, Game of Boobs. So,
Boob of Thrones anyway. Is what I prefer, but, you know,
okay,
go ahead.
Well, change the round. There's been... I don't know how sound of research when you're talking about some of these library association studies, but they did a little bit of stuff looking at whether or not school libraries should stock graphic novel adaptations of classic works, because there was some controversy mm-hmm. over whether you're just basically encouraging kids to cheat and not read the real thing.
Take up less space on the shelf.
And what they found is whether you give it to them in Spark Notes first or a summary on Wikipedia or a graphic novel adaptation first and then let them go, kids are more likely to read and comprehend a classic work, especially the comprehending point. They can do a lot more with it afterwards when you ask them to write about it and kind of judge their absorption of it, if you will, if they have had basically the synopsis first, which is what graphic novels give them. And that kids are more likely to get interested in characters and then go on to read the self-select into reading those classic novels, especially when they looked at things like... Dracula and Jane Eyre and stuff like that, which might
no
not be super
Dracula right off the bat.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. They're not accessible.
They're not super
to teenagers
books.
Or they're yeah, exactly. And so you're basically what they came up with this is that yes, there are value and yes, your library should stock it for your kids and no, you should not allow it instead of the book, like when kids are doing book reports and stuff like that. But it is good to have and provide because then you're generating more interest or whatever. And obviously that's not true in every single case, but
sure.
I guess that is the solution they came up with.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
so these things do have value is what you're saying. You just proved
well,
to me
maybe.
With statistics that maybe
said,
you made up.
I have not read a single one of those.
Yeah, yeah.
I have seen them on the shelves. Like the first year I read comics, it was exclusively through pulling stuff off of the, you know, local library shelf. And I saw them all the time and never once picked one up. So they clearly do not seem appealing to me, but I'm glad there's people out there, you know, teens that are getting into them and then going on to read classic books because I don't get why anyone wouldn't be into books. They're amazing.
Kate really came on this show just to advocate for actual
for real
prose.
Books. For real books.
Uh-oh. Real. What a loaded word.
Okay, hold on.
Oh, boy. We're
just
shutting
kidding.
This down, Mike.
We're going to have another episode all about real books versus real books and what actual real books means.
Yep.
This has been the I Read Books comic podcast. Thank you for listening.
Speaking of which, Mike, you need to read this other book by V.E. Schwab. It's a superhero book.
No, not
the next one in the series. She also wrote one. It's a superhero book or supervillain book, depending on how you look at it, called Vicious. And readers, listeners to the podcast, if you're into comic stuff and like capes, oh my gosh, this is the book for you.
See, I told you, she came on the podcast just to advocate for real prose books.
And libraries. Boo.
Exactly. I mean,
libraries are cool, but if you're renting comic books from them.
Having fun isn't hard if you have a library card.
Thanks for listening to the I Read Comic Books podcast. Our host and producer is Mike Rappin, and the show is edited by Xander Riggs. This week's music was brought to you by Skylar Spence and Infinity Shred. You can find more of Skylar Spence on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/SkylarSpence. And you can find more of Infinity Shred at infinityshred.com. Shout out to Podern Family, a collection of podcasters and their creations of almost any topic. If you're looking for new shows, check out the Podern Family hashtag on Twitter and support small podcasts like us. You can find more of this podcast at our website, ircb.us, or through the podcatcher of your choice. Remember, if you enjoy the show, tell someone about it, rate us online, write to us. If you have a favorite comic book adaptation of a novel, or if you enjoyed one you thought we overlooked, let us know by emailing us at ircb@destroythesaib.org. You can also find the entire podcast team on Twitter, and you can follow the show at ircbpodcast. And don't forget, you can join and spark conversations over on our subreddit at ireadcomicbooks.reddit.com. And again, from all of us here at the podcast, thank you for listening.